This is Christine Downing, February 19th, 1993. Rites of Ancient Ripening, the Transition into the Last Third of Life.
Friday, February 19th, 1993. In our winter series, Seasons of Life, Christine Downing, PhD, will speak this evening on the Rites of Ancient Ripening, the Transition into the Last Third of Life. Introducing the figures of the crone and the senex, the maiden and puer as active archetypes in the last third of life. Exploring both this evening and tomorrow's experiential participatory workshop, the archetypal dimensions of fears and hopes, the blessings and curses to which women and men are exposed as they consciously move toward and into the last third of life. Addressing the figures of the crone and the senex. For our inner lives, long before we outwardly approach age, old age, and how even late in life, these figures continue to contend with the maiden and the puer that lie within us.
A few weeks ago, Lucretia wrote me a letter saying there's a little confusion about whether your lecture and workshop are going to be about midlife and menopause, or about old age and the crone, about the autumn of life or the evening, the autumn or the winter of life, the afternoon or the evening. And I guess my answer to that is, you know, the usual yes. It's going to be about all of the above. But as they appear to me now, as a 60-year-old woman, now 10 years later than, older than, when I wrote my book, Journey Through Menopause. I wrote in that book about my sense that for women, our lives seem to fall into a threefold pattern, marked physiologically by the period before menarche as the first stage, the second stage is the stage during our lives between our first bleeding and our last, and then the third phase marked, the entrance into which is marked by menopause and representing the time in our lives after we've ceased to bleed. So that physiologically there are these three markers, represented in a more mythological way by the figures of maiden, mother, and crone. And what I want to focus on this evening, and to some degree tomorrow as well, is most precisely that transition between the second and the third phase, the transition between mother, from the mother phase or the matron phase or the phase of maturity, to the phase of crone, and how that entails an always half-dreaded engagement with the crone. Now, I think that this transition, the one that I tend to be focusing on, is one that can be understood as a midlife transition, in the sense that, in our culture at least, menopause for most of us women typically happens about halfway through our adult lives. I remember that when I was 50, contemplating my own entrance into menopause, I was aware that my mother was already 80 and that I had lived, you know, 30 years as an adult woman and had a real prospect of living at least another 30 as an adult woman. So there's a sense in which we can see this transition into the last third of life as a kind of midlife crisis. On the other hand, it seems to me that as Jungians typically use the term midlife, it often seems to refer to a somewhat older, earlier period in life, as it certainly did in his life. I think Jung saw his own midlife transition as occurring during that stage in his life which he records in Memories, Dreams, Reflections as his encounter with the unconscious, which happened at about the time that he was 40. And certainly when he talks about seeing himself as a therapist, particularly able to work with people going through a midlife transition, he often seems to have in mind persons going through the kinds of transitions that we confront, perhaps in our late 30s, perhaps in our mid-40s, usually before 50. It also seems to me that when Jung and some of his followers write about the midlife transition, they very often speak of it as though this represents a time of a very dramatic turning away from the more or less extroverted goals and values seen as characteristic of the earlier phase to a more introverted concern with soul. And because of this, there's a sense in which, you know, as we begin to reflect on this notion of midlife crisis in this Jungian kind of frame, it seems to lose any kind of very close anchoring to a chronological period. Because I think that many people who are drawn to Jung, even in their 20s, I know many students that I've worked with who found themselves very drawn to Jung in their 20s or early 30s, are in a sense experiencing already this kind of transition towards the more introverted, the more soul kind of being in the world. I think it also may be true, although I don't want to insist on this, I'm not sure that it's true, but I think it may be true that the sense that there is this kind of dramatic turning from one way of being to another, it may be true that this is more characteristic of male experience than a female experience. I remember reading Murray Stein's book on midlife and being very struck as I was reading it about how, in his view, the midlife transition entails a really kind of violent murdering and then burial of an old self before one's ready to take on a new self. It seems in his writing and some of the other writing by men that I'm familiar with who write about the midlife transition from a Jungian perspective, that there is an emphasis on a kind of radical sense that one either stays the same or one becomes a different person. Whereas I have a hunch, at least, that perhaps, at least for some of us women, there's more of a sense that we can be both same and different. Perhaps that's in part because the inevitability of the physiological transition in our life, the transition from being a menstruating woman to being a menopausal woman, makes the transition from one phase to another seem a more natural one. It's an inevitable one. It's simply part of the pattern that we're going to find ourselves participating in. And I know that I feel very fortunate indeed to have in my body this kind of evidence of the close connections between body and soul, between physiological changes and soul changes. And I do have a sense that during the middle years of our lives, during those years when we do have periods month after month, we have an experience of participating in cycles of extroversion and introversion, cycles of times when our energy seems to naturally be going in a more active, outward, extroverted way, and other times during the month when, if we're really listening to our bodies and our souls, we're pulled to a more within, a more quiescent, more reflective, more introverted kind of phase. So for us, perhaps, introversion and extroversion don't seem like such radical antitheses. They're simply both parts of a pattern that we've been familiar with for a long while. In any case, I am fascinated by the ways in which women's and men's experiences are different and the ways in which they're alike. I've been working for some years now on a book that I seem to keep being diverted from to work on other projects instead. But it's a book I call Orpheus and Eurydice, Male and Female Experiences of the Underworld. And it's a book in which I try to explore how, at least in Greek mythology, the male relationship to the underworld seems so different from the female, that the male relationship to the underworld is that you go there in order to get something from the experience, or to rescue someone who's already in the underworld, or to learn something that's necessary for your functioning in the upper world. Whereas over and over again in mythology, the suggestion seems to be that the women who find themselves in the underworld find that being there has its own meaning and significance, rather than that being there is for the sake of better upper world kind of functioning. So I'm fascinated by ways in which men's and women's experiences may differ, and ways in which they may be alike, because I think we have the capacity to imagine ourselves into the way in which the other gender experiences the world. So we don't need to be locked in to the one that comes with the kinds of bodies that we're given. I'm also very aware that there's no such thing as woman's experience, that we vary enormously among ourselves. And one of the things that really matters to me is discovering these differences, honoring these differences, celebrating these differences. And one of the things that I hope that we'll do in the workshop tomorrow is to discover and honor and celebrate some of these differences between the experiences of the men and of the women in the group, but also ways in which we women differ among ourselves in our relationship to some of this. So I want always to try to encourage more appreciation of these diverse kinds of responses by trying to be aware that I'm speaking to others, among others, rather than for others. That I like to imagine myself as participating in a circle of tellers, a circle of telling. And I want to say here from the beginning, and I think this will become very evident throughout what I say this evening, that inevitably I'm going to be speaking from my own perspective, from my own experience. And so I'm going to be speaking primarily about a woman's experience. So I'm going to be speaking a lot more about the crone than about the Senex, but hopefully in a way that will lead the men here to reflect on how their experience of the Senex is like or different from my experience of the crone. So as I've said, what I want to speak about is the last third of life, about the crone, and also about why it is, how it is, that many of us might prefer instead to speak about midlife and the surge of new energy and redirection that often accompanies midlife transitions, rather than about the losses and endings that we tend to associate with the figure of the crone or Senex. I think that all of us, even when at a kind of conscious level, we're beyond this, but that all of us are still, with some parts of ourselves at least, still very attached to the fantasies of growth, of progress, of renewal. And because of that, talking about midlife is a little more comfortable for us than talking about old age or the crone. I remember that in Simone de Beauvoir's book, Coming of Age, she talks about how the old seems always, no matter what age we find ourselves to be at, that the old seems always to be the other. That we continue to sort of view old age from outside rather than from within. That we're all tempted to do that. So I want to talk about the crone, but I also want to suggest that our engagement with the crone and Senex don't begin when we turn 40 or 50 or 60 or 70, but that these figures inform our inner lives much earlier on, and also that even late in life, these figures don't rule the psyche, but continue to live in lively connection with maiden and mother, or with the puer. So I think that there's a sense in which we have all along a relationship to these figures that represent that last third of life. But I also believe that at midlife or at menopause, it becomes important to establish a more conscious relationship to these figures. And I think that my talk is aimed at encouraging all of us to try and see what associations, what hopes, what fears these figures, the figure of the crone or the Senex, stir in us now. Now, at whatever age we find ourselves to be right now. I do think that very often, as I've suggested, at midlife or at menopause, it suddenly becomes imperative to become more conscious of who these figures are for us. Suddenly becomes important, perhaps because of some radical disruption in our lives. Or perhaps we may feel ourselves having dreams that seem to force such an engagement upon us. I know that that's how it happened for me. As I recount in my book, Journey Through Menopause, at about the time that I was turning 50, when I really hadn't even consciously thought about the fact that I was moving towards the physiological change in my life, I had a series of dreams that made me recognize that I was indeed on the edge of a very serious kind of transition, a transition that was full of promise, but that also evoked some real fears. I had three such dreams, all in a very short period of time. One was a dream that seems to be typical for many women at this stage of life, a dream of finding myself pregnant. There was another dream of actually taking my daughter to the old fairy tale type witch woman who supposedly, according to the dream, my mother had taken me to when I was ready to make the pubertal transition. And then finding that this old woman welcomed me, was very glad to see that I was continuing in this old tradition, bringing my daughter to her as my mother had brought me to her, but that she also recognized that this was time for a ritual, another ritual besides the one that I had consciously come for, that it was time, and that she was absolutely determined that she was going to put me through a ritual, which would be a menopausal kind of ritual. And then thirdly, I had another dream that ended up being a very fearful dream, which was a dream of dismemberment, a dream of having myself all cut into pieces and ending up being a bowl of fruit salad in a refrigerator, which in this dream, in the strange kind of way in which in dreams one can play more than one role at a time, I kept bringing people to the refrigerator and saying, see, that's me. And nobody quite understanding. It's a very fearful kind of dream. And it made me aware that the three dreams together made me very aware that this life transition that I was moving towards was one that it was very important for me to honor, not just as a body event, but also as a soul event. And as a transition full of promise, but also full of precarious transition as well. And I became aware that for me it was going to be very important to live this transition in a ritualized, in a symbolic kind of way, to really celebrate that this was a soul event, as I've said, and not just a bodily event. And I was very aware that, like all rites of passage, this one would entail the three steps of preparation, transition, and return. My book is really dedicated to trying to articulate how I myself lived through those three phases, my preparation for menopause, my actual living through that transition, and then what it was like to find myself immediately on the other side of it. But since then, actually I mentioned this in the book, but I don't think I knew it as well at the time that I wrote the book. You know, we often say things that we half understand, but we don't recognize the full implications of when we're saying them. I also talked about my awareness that although I see a woman's life as divided into these three phases of the maiden, the mother, and the crone, that I also recognize that there's a sense in which within each of those phases there are three phases. And as I look back now at what I was able to say when I wrote that book 10 years ago, I would say that everything I wrote about menopause in that book pertains to the preparatory phase of the third stage of life. That as I look back now, I can also see how some of the big changes that I thought I was participating at that time in my life have ended up not being quite as big, quite as complete as I had at that time thought them to be. For instance, and this is just a very little thing, it seemed very clear to me that I was moving from being Chris to being Christine. And I told everybody that from henceforward, I was going to be Christine. But I realized that hasn't really taken. You know, that I use Christine more than I used to. But there are a lot of ways and lots of aspects of my life in which I still feel much more natural, much more comfortable still being Chris. I also talked in that book about how I felt myself to be at a time of moving towards a much more introverted, kind of home-based kind of time. Instead, I have to be honest and say that the last decade has been the most productive decade in my life. I've written 6 books since I wrote Journey Through Menopause, you know? Which doesn't mean the other wasn't true, because I've been writing in a different way. I have been writing in a way that is more reflective and that depends on introversion and so on. But it's still, I have to also say, it's different from how I'd imagined it to be at that time. And looking back, the way I put this now, and it relates to the way I understand what I want to say here this evening, I would want to say that when I wrote that book 10 years ago, I was a maiden crone. You see what I mean? Okay. I feel myself now to be at a different place in relation to the figure of the crone. I know, for instance, that because 3 months ago, 4 months ago, or whatever, I knew I was going to be coming here and supposedly talking at least in some ways in relation to menopause, I went out and bought these new books that are out now, Gail Shee's book and Germaine Greer's. But you know, I have to confess, I haven't read them. I'm just not that interested anymore for myself. I'm so glad they're out there, you know? And I'm so glad that this generation of women 10 years younger than I are all wanting to sort of talk about it in a way that no one was talking about it 10 years ago. But it isn't my, those aren't my issues anymore. And I'm very aware of not being able to name exactly where I am now. I just know I'm not there anymore. I know that I'm now and somehow more in the middle phase, and that a lot of things have happened for me in the last 6 months or so that mark this for me, that I want to name. There, some of them are things that might have happened at another time, but they've all happened together somehow, and that has made them signally important for me. As Lucretia was saying, I've just retired. I didn't want to retire now. Some of you may know about the state budget crisis in California and so on. And the consequence of that for me was that people in my department were sort of given a choice that if those of us in the department over 60 would be willing to retire, the mid-career people wouldn't have to be fired. And pretty obvious what one does in that kind of a situation. But it means that I'm suddenly finding myself in a different place from where I'd expected to be and a different place from where I would have chosen to be right now. And I'm mourning the loss of something that I've done for 30 years that I love doing and that I do well. But I think that mourning has been complicated, deepened by the fact that I also this summer lost my closest friend to AIDS, a man 10 years younger than I, that I knew was going to die, but it still is not being here anymore, is still very hard for me. I'm a 60-odd-year-old woman, but this is the first death of someone truly intimate in my life. And so I'm still coming to terms with that. I had a much smaller thing happen last spring. I broke my wrist. No big deal. But it was the first time in my life that I had to really experience in a physical kind of way these things that I write about and talk about so wonderfully, about being vulnerable and dependent and having to let somebody else take care of me and so on. It's easier to write about than to live. I also, last summer, or last September, I guess, actually, went back to East Germany, where I was born, but which I left when I was 4 years old, and to which I'd not returned in the almost 60 years since then. And that's meant a very deep engagement with my own past, with the past of Germany in this century, with my parents' early lives, and so on. And all of those are all parts of what's been going on for me now. And I want to name those because they're parts of what, for me, are about where I'm speaking from and therefore, in part, what I'm able to speak about. I'm very aware that there's still so much for me to live, to learn, to relearn about what this last third of life is all about. For the last 15 years or more, I've looked to mythology, to the goddesses of Greece, to help me discern what the archetypal dimensions of the particular challenges and blessings associated with whatever I'm going through might be. And I've certainly found in Greek mythology lots of resources for understanding in a deep and symbolic way what this last third of a woman's life is all about. I found, for instance, how much I've learned from some of the traditions about Hera. Some of you may recall how Hera, in the last third of her life, the phase in her life that's known as the Hera-Kera, or Hera, the separated one phase, she finally leaves that marriage, which has mostly been such an unhappy relationship for her and goes back to her mother's homeland and there bathes in a magic spring which has the power to renew her virginity. And it's as though what Hera does there is not undo the fact that she's been in that relationship, not undo the fact that she's had the children that she's had, but rediscover herself as someone whose center is in herself. Rediscover her virginity in Esther Harding's sense, her in herselfness. And I think that that's, you know, a very important aspect of what this last third of life can be about for many of us. I find the relevance of Artemis, and Artemis who is so clearly associated with the recognition that the blood mysteries of a woman's life are sacred, and that these transitions that are associated with those aspects of our physiology peculiar to women are sacred transitions. And that in order to live them deeply, we have to be in touch with that sacrality. But most importantly, perhaps not too surprisingly, as I turn to Greek mythology for illumination of this transition, I find myself continually returning to the myth of Demeter and Persephone. I've just finished an anthology of many different responses to this myth. And I was struck as I gathered together all these different essays about the Demeter-Persephone myth, how many women, I'm thinking particularly now of Helen Luth, of Patricia Berry, and of Polly Young Eisendroth, have talked about this myth as being a myth that is really about Demeter's midlife transition, a myth about Demeter's learning that she has to let go of her attachment to her being in the world as mother. And how Luke particularly talks about how the rage and the grief that Demeter feels at her loss are absolutely appropriate. It's right to feel that, but it's also something that needs to be gotten over, that she needs to come to accept that this loss, this change in her life is an inevitable and appropriate one. And I also see in this myth, of course, Persephone's own discovery that her true being is goddess of the underworld as being an encouragement to all of us to recognize the time spent in the underworld, time spent involved with experiences of endings, of losses, of failure, of guilt, of abandonment, and so on, are time spent with sacred and meaningful events, not time out from our lives, but time deeply in our lives. But I also think of the way in which the three other female figures in this myth help us understand this transition. I think of Baubo, who at least for a moment is able to get Demeter to recognize that there may be more to a woman's being than her her capacity for maternal love and devotion. You remember Baubo was the old woman who tries to cheer Demeter up while she's so deeply immersed in her grief by doing this obscene dance after having let Demeter tell her the story, you know, about the terrible thing that happens to her, and Baubo nods and says, yes, that is really terrible. And then she starts doing this dance where she is so into her, you know, this old woman with her flaccid, wrinkled body. She is so into her delight in this body as her own body. You know, when she engages in this striptease, and finally she just shoves her vulva into Demeter's face, and Demeter just bursts out laughing. And there's also so that Demeter has a glimpse at least of this sense that there is life after motherhood, and that women's sexuality, women's being, is sacred in itself. And there's also the figure of Rhea, the grandmotherly figure in the tale, who is able to persuade Demeter that there's a way of relating to her daughter different from the possessive kind of love that had characterized her earlier loving. And above all, of course, there's Hecate. There's Hecate, who is the crone par excellence in Greek mythology. And in this myth of Persephone and Demeter, Hecate is the one who sees the abduction, sees Persephone being pulled into the underworld, and doesn't feel any need to intervene, sees what happens as a necessary event. And she's also the one who then lights Persephone's way back up to rejoin her mother, and the one who guarantees that the change will nevertheless be honored, that Persephone will henceforward return to spend part of each year in her underworld abode. And Hecate represents the sacredness of all transitions, and particularly these transitions between upper world and underworld, between life and death. And the other thing that really intrigues me about Hecate, and that I wrote about in my book, is the way in which Hecate in Greek mythology is pictured as being accompanied by howling dogs and hungry ghosts. And that what these ghosts represent are the souls of those who died too young, or murdered, or weren't ritually buried. And so that Hecate, this retinue that accompanies Hecate, I think represents the way in which, as we go through our transitions, there's always that danger of our being haunted in some very frightening ways indeed with that which it's time to have died, you know, it's time to let go of, but that we haven't ritually buried, that we haven't really dealt with the fact this needs to be let go of. So I think that there's a lot to be learned from these mythological figures. There's a lot to be learned from discovery of where we feel ourselves to be. I do know, for instance, that I've come to see, and that no matter what I'm reflecting on, whatever I write, at this time in my life, the same themes seem to keep reappearing. The necessity of our coming to terms with change, with interdependence, and death. And these, it seems to me, are a crone's themes. But I also have a deepening, ever-deepening sense that the she from whom I will learn what I most need to know now is not these goddess figures, is not even my own inner self, but living other women. So as I've tried to understand what the crone means, who the crone is for me, I've spent a lot of time listening to the testimony of women older than myself, other women who tried to engage this figure. I know that this word crone is a word that stirs up profound ambivalence in me, and I imagine in most of us. On the one hand, I feel myself unworthy of the designation. I know myself, I'm not wise enough, not completed enough, not old enough, not transcendent enough. On the other hand, I feel myself still too powerful, too active, too happy and healthy to be her. There's a part of me that keeps saying, not yet, not yet. Maiden Mother Crone. The more I reflect on this trinity, the more elusive it becomes. At first, it seems to refer to three discrete stages of female development. But then I sense this doesn't quite fit. Maiden evokes some aspects of female experience that aren't fully experienced in youth, and that are actually part of our lifelong sense of ourselves. And the same, I believe, is true of mother and crone. I've remembered all these years now how during my 30s a man who had initially been drawn to me by the sophistication and sexual allure I seemed to embody, later told me that what he'd really come to delight in most was the playful little girl he had discovered me still to be. And what he had come to value most was the wise old woman who appeared from time to time. All three, in some sense, coexist within us all along. And perhaps we feel fully known only by those who are able to discern their co-presence. In a sense, the maiden represents an irrecoverable, because never literally possible, innocence, inviolability, self-sufficiency. The crone, a longed-for but to some degree unrealizable attainment of a fulfilled wisdom and power. But I'm not happy with a view that focuses only on the positive side of the archetype and ignores the confusion, loneliness, vulnerability, and emptiness of the maiden, and the incompletion, impotence, vulnerability of the crone. Such avoidance of the darker side seems to occur when we allow archetypes to exist independently of actual lives or actual myths. As I try to articulate, understand more clearly my own relationship to being and becoming an old woman, to look at the sense in which I have been one, known one to live within me for decades, the sense in which since I went through menopause, I am one now, the sense in which my mother is one and I am not yet, the sense in which one never fully becomes her. When I was a maiden, I hardly knew it. My recognition of the ways in which my personal struggles echoed age-old archetypal patterns came mostly retrospectively. In other words, I didn't think of myself as maiden when I was maiden. I came to that later as I sought to honor the continued presence in me of the maiden, or perhaps better, virgin in Esther Harding's sense of in oneselfness, at a time when outwardly I seemed to be identified with the mother. From the perspective of the mother, the maiden is seen as all prospect. She's full of anticipation, of looking forward. She represents female existence before it is in touch with the dimensions of experience central to the mother phase, before sexuality, before birth giving, before engagement with the underworld. So actually, when one is maiden, it's never so innocent a state of being. One may already be all too familiar with underworld reality. One may find oneself just as defined by relationships or by the pain of their inadequacy or absence as later on. The idealization of the maiden phase is the mother's, who, looking back, in a sense creates the maiden as emblem of an aspect of her own self whose loss she mourns or whose fragile persistence she fiercely defends. Persephone's innocence, in other words, is Demeter's fantasy. He celebrated the fulfillments that came with birthing and helping to raise my 5 children, and yet experiencing mother as both too grandly archetypal and too personally constraining. But my disavowal of the crone feels different, as though the disavowal were itself integral to what the archetype implies, requires, gives, and withholds. Perhaps to fully acknowledge one's identity with her would be to die. I believe that my disavowal is not mine alone. I see my mother, almost 90, in fact she'll be 90 next week, still warding her off. As I read the accounts of women much older than I attempting to articulate their experience of being 70 or 80 or 90, I discover how for them too there is acknowledgement of the crone and denial. Perhaps this is because the crone is inherently a transcendent figure. She stirs ambivalence in us. women of my age inevitably remember the negative connotations crone and its analog, hag and witch, harpy, shrew, virago, used to evoke. These words refer to ugly old women, to repulsive and terrifying women who were in compact with evil spirits, to the primordial other. We've celebrated the reclaiming of the language of these words by such feminists as Mary Daly and Barbara Walker. We have learned to apply these terms proudly to ourselves. Revisionings have encouraged us to think of crones as long-lasting survivors, as wise and powerful, self-affirming women, as wanton, willful, intractable women, as women who refuse to yield to patriarchal power and thus represent all that men find terrifying in independent women. Yet I find something too simple in this positive feminist view of the crone. It equates the crone with the power of women-identified women, which men find frightening and ugly, and consequently calumniate and vilify. But it doesn't seem fully to recognize the crone as the old woman. Walker makes clear that by crone, she means socially active elder women, women beyond their young mother years, women of middle age and beyond. Daily, that she means to emphasize the intractable spirit, not the age of crones and hags. The sense we get is that the crone is woman as resolutely not mother, perhaps never mother, at the very least after mother. These women, more or less my contemporaries, are proud to call themselves crones, but in a way that seems to ignore the realities of true old age and the dark side of the crone archetype. I find myself suspicious of these midlife crones. I'm less sure than they that only men are frightened of the crone, for I believe that she may represent something in ourselves that frightens us and that we avoid by claiming that we are already crones. I value Sandra Scofield's warning of the dangers inherent in the urgent desire, her words, to find old age a happy part of life's cycle, and thus to ignore the faults, the bitterness, the regrets of old women. The result is sentimental, cloying, and I suspect false. I want to know how the old absorb their losses, how they look back on lost opportunity and bear disappointments in their family and friends. I want to know how they live with their dark sides. I also talk here about how many older women resent midlife women speaking about crones as though midlife women are crones. Therefore really refusing old women the opportunity to speak about what this means to them, unconsciously silencing the inherent radicalism of the only ones who can really tell us how it is. So I think that there are dangers with a kind of premature identification with the crone. I also see the dangers in denying the identification. Many of these women whose writings I've been engaged with talk about their anger at what they call the self-deception involved in passing for younger than we are. Talk about how easily we women get seduced into liking to hear that that someone can't believe that we're as old as we are. You don't look that old. At first, one of these women says, at first that felt like a compliment. Then I became a bit uneasy. It reminded me of early pre-feminist days when I was complimented by some men for being smarter, more independent than those other women. So I realize I need to ask what fear, what rage, what misogyny am I hiding from in regarding the crone as other? I imagine it's hard for any woman with a still living mother to take quite seriously her own identification as a crone. I was struck last summer when I went to a gathering of crones, who all ended up being about my age, that what most of us wanted to talk about was our mothers. And I found this to be true in so many of the deep conversations I've had with women of my age, that we're engaged with our relationship to our mothers as we haven't been since we became mothers ourselves. And that what so many of us voice is concern with the unhappiness, the rage, the helplessness, the dependence on us, evidenced by so many of our mothers. But secondly, and somehow even more forcibly, over and over again, I hear, and I hear it in myself as well, our fear of becoming them. When once we might have said, I don't want to grow up to be like her, now we hear ourselves saying, I don't want to grow old like her. We know that's not rational. I know it's not rational. I've made very different decisions in my life from those my mother made in hers. There's very little likelihood that I would feel the same anger at gifts not actualized, at recognitions not received, at status not acquired, at a life partner for whom I've sacrificed my life that fills my mother's obsessive litany. I feel deep sympathy for her. I understand that her rage is one that feminist analysis justifies, yet it terrifies me. I feel for and with her, and I'm angry at her for being unhappy, but really because I'm afraid I will become her. I'm so aware of how even now she is in me, in my body, in my gait, my smile, my frown, my gestures. Not so much in facial resemblance as in the expressiveness that somehow, the expressions that somehow feel even more personal than the shape of my nose or the color of my eyes. She already is in me, and there's this kind of fear that she might take me over. I know many other old women, some of whom seem much happier than my mother. I'm moved and impressed by the creativity continuing into advanced old age of women like Meredith LeSueur or Georgia O'Keeffe or Louise Nevelson or Martha Graham. Nevertheless, the exemplar of the crone for me remains my mother. And I think that for many of us, as we approach old age, disentangling the personal mother from the archetype, from the crone, becomes difficult again. I thought I did that long ago, but there it is, needing to be done again. I'll skip this part. So many of these women that I've been trying to learn from about their own experience of their relationship to being older women is that over and over again they warn us against projecting wisdom or beneficent power on them, just as ardently as they admonish us not to identify them with weakness or ugly destructive power. They suggest that perhaps these apparent opposites are in reality a two sides of the same evasion of the actualities of old women's self-understanding. Yet perhaps at the archetypal level, it is not so much that neither is true, but that both are. What we need to do is to look at the wisdom and ignorance, the power and vulnerability, the peace and rage, the generosity and selfishness of the crone, and at her distance from and closeness to us. I find myself going back to the etymology which links crone to an old Dutch word for old you or dead body, and then traces it back to the Latin carn, flesh, and therefore sees crone as cognate with carnal, carnival, and incarnate. I like this recognition that crones are embodied, this suggestion that we cannot do justice to who the crone is unless we associate her with her aging body and expect that her soul state will be related to her body state. This, like so much else, is two-edged. We women have been socialized to attach so much significance to our body's appearance, and thus may find accepting our body's aging difficult. We may invest much energy in trying to inhibit the appearance of wrinkles or disguise the appearance of gray hair. No matter how feminist we are, most of us have interjected some of these messages about our bodies. And yet, if we seek to modify our bodies to meet these standards, we may achieve instead an awful estrangement from our bodies. Obviously, we're better off in those moments when we become genuinely interested in the physical changes occurring in our body. You know, fascinated with the appearance of these brown spots on our arms and our chest, the veins on our hands, the facial lines that record my anxieties and delights, the skin hanging loose on my upper arm, the flat and flaccid buttocks, the thinning pubic hair. I remember how I felt when I was pregnant, and awe at my body's knowledge of how to do this, and awe I've also felt about menstruating, about orgasm, against nursing, but have only recently and not consistently felt about aging. This idea that my body knows how to do this, it will teach me. But such acceptance is not easily won. And the acceptance we may indeed achieve may cohabit with regret. Regret based on something much deeper than just identification with youthful attractiveness and sexual allure. The regret at being mortal. Because obviously, the body that knows how to age is a body preparing to die. And old women not only have to come to terms with their own oncoming death, but also with the way that they are viewed as representatives of death, as death bringers. Walker sees the projection of death fear as true of men's imaginings of the old woman. She sees it as representing the symbolic feminization of man's ultimate fear, the fear of his final non-existence, the fear of the common garden variety of death rather than the hero's sudden, violent, glorious death. But death from wasting disease, death after slow degeneration of body and mind. The death-bringing crone becomes, in the male imagination, Walker says, a castrator, most vividly imagined as a collector of severed penises. But I believe that the crone plays this role in women's imaginings as well. And furthermore, that we need images of death, images which honor our fear of death as well as our acceptance. Walker believes that for women, the crone is associated with ancient images of benevolent goddesses who welcome and protect women in the land of the dead. I find this image of women as unambiguously reconciled with death as too simple. It may be true that we women have an easier time accepting our human participation in the natural cycles of life, death, and renewal than do men. But I'm not persuaded it's easy, even for us. Much of the power of Audre Lorde's description of her wrestling with liver cancer comes from her acknowledgement of the months of denial, the moments of rage and despair, as well as from the account of eventually coming to a wish to live whatever I live, whatever life I have, as fully and sweetly as possible. I'm interested in the very many different ways women die, in those who go gentle into the dark night and those who refuse to. I suspect that the longing for the crone to mean a fully worked through acceptance of death is connected to the persistent fantasy of the possibility of a truly completed life. I've watched the power of this fantasy over my parents as they communicate how painful it is for them when one or another of their children or their 9 grandchildren are going through a time of confusion. They want so much to have everything be in place before they die. Carolyn Heilbrunn believes this fantasy has particular power over women, We women, she writes, have lived too much with closure. There always seems to loom the possibility of something being over, settled, sweeping clear the way for contentment. This, she says, is the delusion of the passive life. And I have come to realize how important it is to get past the sense of life as closure, of death as closure on something rounded off. Embracing the crone, making her our ally, seems in so many ways to be more difficult than we might wish. We want so much affirmation from her that in the end it will be easy. We want her to stand before us, not only as a woman fearless before death, but as a woman powerful in life. I have deep reservations about an emphasis on the crone's power, especially if we forget how much of the crone's peculiar power lies in her acknowledgement of weakness and of need for others, and of her hatred of that fragility and dependence. Did I say that clearly enough? So I'm saying that it seems to me important to recognize that the particular kind of power that belongs to the crone is a power that depends in part, that's connected with her acknowledgement of weakness and need for others, and also of her recognition of how much she dislikes her fragility and dependence. You know, really acknowledging that dark side. Florida Scott Maxwell, for instance, affirms the importance of acknowledging that though age is more than disability, it is a disability. She says, being old, I'm out of step, troubled by my lack of concord, unable to like or understand much that I see, feeling at variance with the times must be the essence of age, and is confusing, wounding. I feel exposed, bereft. She also voices the fear shared by so many older women of the real possibility of suffering a more complete powerlessness, of becoming invalids, of completely losing their independence. Whereas others speak of the crone's power, she speaks of her heroic helplessness. I like that. She also gives us a sense of the rage that may possess the old. Speaking of her life as being lightly peppered with despair, she confides, disabilities crowd in on the old, real pain is there, and if we have to be falsely cheerful, it is part of our isolation. In silent, hot rebellion, we cry silently, I've lived my life, haven't I? What more is expected of me? Have we got to pretend out of noblesse oblige that age is nothing in order to encourage the others? And Helen Luke speaks of helpless rage as one of the gifts of old age, but without the unquestioning approbation of women's anger and rage that sometimes accompanies reflections on the crone. There is valid anger, Luke says. There is creative anger. But not all the anger felt by contemporary old women or by the old women of mythology is proportionate, valid, or effective. Luke describes how often the old remain unaware of underlying despair, yet sink into a careless state, expressed by projecting all their ills onto circumstances and sometimes onto those on whom they now depend and most need. Old age, she says, is an occasion for learning to see differently, for coming to see that the darkness that we're tempted to project onto others or onto circumstances, that darkness is our own, yet also a time for winning freedom from what she sees as a kind of hubristic, inflated guilt about our failures that supposes that we should have been able to live a life free of culpability or guilt. Ideally, Luke suggests, the old would arrive at a transformed rage, which would accept the givenness of their suffering and yet would still welcome release from it. And just as the power of the crone is, as I've been trying to suggest, a strange kind of power, so her wisdom seems to be a strange kind of wisdom, a wisdom permeated with the recognition of how little one knows, and of how apart from that acknowledgement, one is really no wiser than one ever was before. The crone is busily engaged with her memories, with telling her story to herself and to all who will listen. The Greeks believed that what occupied the psyches, the souls of the dead in Hades, was remembering, not new experience, new thoughts, but simply going over and over the already lived. Remembering becomes remembering, putting the pieces together to make a new whole. I have listened to my mother going over and over the same vividly recalled events from her years as a child, as a young woman, as middle-aged. Often from outside, it seems as though no progress is being made, no new insights gained. Often from inside, evidently, it feels as though this remembering is almost a passive experience happening to one. As Scott Maxwell puts this, she says, it amounts to this, that near the end of my life, when I am myself as never before, I am awareness at the mercy of multiplicity. Ideas drift in like bright clouds, arresting, momentary, but they come as visitors. A shaft of insight can enter the back of my mind, and when I turn to greet it, it's gone. I did not have it, it had me. My mind is light and dancing, or it's leaden. It is not I who choose my moods. I accept them. But from whom? And I, as I listen to my mother, I know that what she is doing is clearly work, not just passive recall. Many of her memories are painful memories, often somehow apparently more painful when remembered than when lived. She is learning to see them differently, to see herself differently. But the new perspective must be rediscovered over and over again before it is fully absorbed. Luke sees such reevaluating of our past as the point of such remembering. We may discover to our horror, she says, how much of what we've done that we were most satisfied with was really done for recognition, comfort, or spiritual merit. How much we thought virtuous or kind really brought harm to others. How in most of our actions there was as much evil as good, though it is still important, she believes, to have aimed at the good. Scott Maxwell agrees, one has ample time to face everything one has had, been, done. Gather them all in, the things that came from outside and those from inside. We have time at last to make them truly ours. As I look at the much vaunted independence of the crone, I notice especially how often she is imagined as essentially alone. Mae Sarton, Helen Luke, and Florida Scott Maxwell each seem to see their solitude as deeply informing their capacity to live old age deeply and honestly. Maxwell Scott, for example, says, I am so busy being old that I dread interruptions. Elsa Gidlow agrees, what I needed as I neared my 70th decade was freedom from commitment to any one individual. I've often wondered how different my mother's experience of being old might be were my father not still alive. Would it be easier to move from projecting her rage onto others toward the kind of working through which the old sometimes achieved without another so readily available to carry that projected rage? I wonder about this for myself, too. Is there a kind of attending to one's soul that is one of the primary tasks of age, which being centrally engaged in a relationship makes almost impossible? I wonder whether the relationship that presently appears so unquestionably blessed and blessing, a part of my life, will seem so a decade or two or three from now. As I have sought to attend to what old women have said of their experience of aging, I've come to believe that there is a sense in which no one is a crone, in the sense of knowing what it is to be one. As Barbara MacDonald reminds us, even the 70-year-olds, even those in their 80s and 90s, are discovering what it's all about. We're all beginning, all but initiates in the rites of ancient ripening, of which Merida LeSueur sings, and this is her LeSueur's poem. Ceremonials of water and fire, lodge me in the deep earth, grind my harvest seed. The rites of ancient ripening make my flesh plume and summer winds stir in my smoked bowl. There is a sense in which we all still stand as maidens before the crone, before any of life's mysteries. And in all of our passages, we confront the awesomeness of endings and death, of a familiar way of being. In all of our passages, it seems to me, we confront Persephone in her crone aspect of goddess of the underworld, as goddess of the underworld and goddess of souls. I think all, in a sense, no matter how conscious we seek to become, find ourselves unprepared for the transitions, the rites of passage, of separation that confront us, whether we are 20 or 40 or 60 or 80. And I think there's a sense in which all our passages are midlife passages. The words of others, the images of myth, cannot preserve us from having to find our own way. As Adrienne Rich writes, in Toward the Solstice, and I want to finish with this poem of Adrienne Rich's. I like that it was called Toward the Solstice, partly, Lucretia, because of what you wrote about this evening, in a way, being the winter ritual for the Jung Society here. So this is part of Adrienne's poem. And it's about the way in which we have to find our own way through these transitions. If some rite of separation is still unaccomplished between myself and the long-gone tenants of this house, between myself and my childhood and the childhood of my children, it is I who have neglected to perform the needed acts. Set water in corners, light and eucalyptus in front of mirrors, or merely pause and listen to my own pulse, vibrating lightly as falling snow, relentlessly as the rainstorm, and hear what it has been saying. It seems I am still waiting for them to make some clear demand, some articulate sound or gesture, for release to come from anywhere but from inside myself. So now we should take a little break, and then if you want to come back, we can have some discussion. Yes?
What was the proportion to the quoted during the lecture, if I understood it correctly, spoke as if the person's recollection in old age would be more negative somehow than these things they were experienced at the time that they happened. I was struck by that. I think that personally it burdened through most of my life by that sort of thing. My recollection's more negative than the immediate experience. And probably by an expectation of recollection in old age in particular, being shifted towards negative. And I just wondered if by quoting that you were accepting that state of affairs, or whether you believe in doing better than that in the way that you
I think my answers are very often take the shape. It's going to be a kind of yes and no answer. Let me just first, I was asked to repeat the questions if I could, and I'm going to just very briefly say that what seems to me what you're asking about is whether I agree with one of the women that I was quoting towards the end of my presentation that the remembering that seems to play such an important role in old age will characteristically see those events in the past in more painful terms than they may have been experienced as when we were first living them. And the yes and the no has a lot of different aspects. One is that I think that if you were in the habit always of, you know, looking back at the past and seeing it in terms of a failure or a guilt, you know, if you've always seen it negatively, that probably it may very well be that when you come to old age, you're blessed with being able to see things in a lighter kind of way. In other words, see, I don't think it's the same for all of us. You know, for instance, one of the things that was, became very clear to me after I'd written my menopause book was that for me, who had spent my middle years in a very kind of active, out-in-the-world, career-oriented, receiving recognitions and so on kind of way, that the journey through menopause was an opportunity to move into a more reflective, less out there kind of time. And yet I found that for many women, it was exactly the opposite. You know, women who had spent their mid-years very much in a home-centered kind of way, suddenly menopause finally could go out in the world. You know, and so on the outside, it looks opposite, but there's a way in which we were both sort of doing what we hadn't done before, you know. And but the other thing I wanted to say is that I think that what the woman I was quoting was trying to communicate, and also what I see is true in my mother's life, is that there is a discovery that moments that one was able to somehow just sort of absorb and get through, or things that one did that one was able to feel pretty proud about and so on, had a more painful dimension to them, that part of looking at them, you may discover, you know, as I said, I think that this is true for me already, that I'm beginning to see that things that I did that I thought were really done for the benefit of others, yeah, may have had some benefit, but there also were a lot of ways in which they may have had some harmful aspects too. And things that I saw myself as doing really for others were also things I was doing in order to feel good about myself and so on, you know, that kind of thing. But I think that what I see happening in my mother, and what I think Helen Luke was also trying to say, was that there is a way of, as you go through these memories and you come to terms with what was painful, or where moments where you were culpable or responsible, or moments where you still feel that you were wounded or abandoned or whatever, that there's a way of feeling that pain, but of working through it, of accepting it, of not being mired in it, of not being still in rage against the pain, but of coming to a more kind of equable, yeah, life has that in it, and my life had it in it. Who am I to think my life wouldn't have it in it? You see what I mean?
I look for more than coming to an observation with major aspects of painful.
Uh-huh.
I really hope to do what I would call better than that. Maybe it's important, but I have no idea. I'm sure I'm wrong with that. Fine, but that's what I look for right now.
And I think many of us do. I think that particularly many Jungians do. I think that there is something about Jung's whole psychology that tends to lead us towards promises or anticipations or hopes of completions, fulfillments, And this is a place where I just have to be candid about where I am. This is a place where I'm more of a Freudian. You know, Freud talked about, very early in his life, he talked about the goal of analysis or therapy being having neurotic misery transformed into common unhappiness. All right? Now, a lot of Jungians say how awful, you know? But I just have to say that I really am there. You know, I believe that to be a human being is to be a finite, limited being, and there's suffering in life, there's incompletion in life, and that the challenge is to come to terms with that. So that's my reading, you know. Yes. Yes, it is. I'm just saying that there are ways of reading Jung that I agree with you completely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we all have those longings. See, that's part of what even Freud would say. You know, that part of being human is to have those dreams, those longings, those fantasies of the, you know, of the fulfillment, of the closure, of the completion. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I guess when you before the story, yeah. And I guess I wonder, maybe you'll have an opportunity tomorrow to talk more about where that comes from, perhaps in terms of the year.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, there is a lot of where story is coming from in terms of if it's true, you know, you do, you're also going to go to the
right. And
coming, never getting the therapy.
Well, you know, I also would say that I see Freud himself as someone who came to terms with you know, enormous, unremitting, daily physical pain for the last 17 years of his life, and with his death in an exemplary kind of way. So there's a real kind of coming to terms. Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's so true, and yet I'm so aware of how, for me, there's a way in which something almost opposite has also happened. My parents are both still alive, and as I said, my mother's going to be 90 next week, and my father's 92. And I think when they were in their 80s, I felt I was kind of, or in their early 80s, I felt I was kind of prepared for them to die. I'm not at all sure I'm prepared anymore because they seem so immortal at this point.
The flash my mind was this.
Yeah.
So when someone says, oh, damn, and then life, I'm looking for question one, but am I correct to say that probably a popular thing to do? And if I am correct,
okay, I have two answers. One is, I think it's true, you know, depends what people you're talking about when you talk about popular in a sense, because I think it is true that for many women today, Crone and Hag and so on have been reframed in such a way that I think almost the opposite has happened, as I was trying to say earlier. So they're viewed in this, you know, they're the wise, powerful, independent, strong, you know. So I think there's been that kind of revaluation. But I also think that there's a more ancient kind of thing that has some of these negative views. And I also believe that most of us, even if we consciously, politically avow the more positive one, that we still carry around some of those other associations. Because they've just been around so long in the literature, in the folk tales, in the language and everything. They don't get erased from some of the deepest strata of our associations just because we've taught ourselves to look at it differently. And I think that part of I can see at least immediately two different reasons for that, those negative connotations. And one is that more women appropriately are angry and full of rage and bitter and unhappy and so on when they're old. And that's because of what we call patriarchy. All right. I skipped the page in my notes here about some of the details of my mother's anger. But part of it is my mother's anger at the restrictions on her life. And that this is particularly vivid for her because she looks at her daughters, whose gifts and energies and so on were very like her own, but who've had lives of much more extensive fulfillment than she. And she's just angry. She's angry at all the things she didn't get. And she blames, as I said, she blames Hitler, she blames my father, she blames patriarchy. And she's unable to see what I might say is some choice points along the way when some women of her generation took a different path, you know. But anyway, there's that kind of anger. And it makes, I mean, women who you can say their anger is justified or so on, but a woman who's possessed by that kind of bitterness and disappointment, so it's a kind of scary person to be around, or an unpleasant person to be around. And we've all known older women like that, you know? So that's part of it. But then I think there's another, even deeper part of it. And that relates to what gives rise to patriarchy in the beginning, which is that woman is associated, for men and women alike, with the source of life. And the source of life, the fact that we are given life by another, also means that we are creatures who were not, right? And will not be, all right? So the fact that our very being here is contingent on the mother, the woman, means that we are contingent, finite, mortal, to die creatures. And none of us want that, right? And so that's projected onto women, you know, is the fear of death and the fear of age and so on, because woman is seen as the source of life and the source of death. That's my, yeah. But you know, I wonder also, and this is just off the top of my head, but you know, as we reflect on the kinds of wisdom that we most hunger for as we ourselves move towards old age, whether we're more likely to anticipate receiving that kind of guidance and so on from a man or a woman. And I would say that for many of us, men or women alike, that we'd have an intuition that maybe a woman would have more of that. I don't know, but
as I listen to you, I see the woman, the fear, and the happened, what happened. And the old man that is the clinical stage to what the world is doing, what it has done, what it will be.
You know, I hope that maybe we could explore that tomorrow. I can't give you an answer. I'm not an analyst. And so I don't, you know, I haven't really worked with the dreams of men. Do you see what I'm saying? So I can't, if it was an analyst up here talking, she could reflect back on her practice and give you an answer to that. I instead would have to ask, you know, some of the men here to talk about what some of those dreams have been like. The only thing that I can say, and I can't remember, I know I had it in my notes, but I can't remember if I got around to saying it, but I don't think I did, is that when Jim Hillman has written about the Senex, which is the figure of the old man, he has seen the Senex as representing rigidity, as representing order, and it's a very different kind of vision of what the old represents than what seems to be associated with the crone. But I don't know if we start asking, you know, the men in the group about what their own associations with the figure of the old man are, either from their dreams or from their memories or just their free associating. I don't know what we'd find. Yeah. Yeah, well, our culture certainly is all oriented in that kind of way. Okay, one more, if there is one. Maybe we're really done anyway. Yeah, well, and that's partly what I was trying to say, that, I mean, I can look back and see choice points, right? Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that Simone de Beauvoir, you know, also tries to say, that there's something very attractive, actually, to all of us humans, to be the defined, to be the dependent, you know, be taken care of and so on. Yeah. Right. Right. That's right. No question. No question. Okay.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.